right out of the box this afternoon. We've got a terrific guest for you. He's a journalist and author of books, including Orson Welles' last movie, A Futile and Stupid Gesture. He was co-producer of the terrific Orson Welles documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. We are pleased to be joined by Josh Karp. Josh, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
On the second go-round, since I screwed up and I forgot you last week. That's awful.
It was devastating, but I've recovered.
I'm glad to hear that. I don't know where to begin because you have written about three of the most fascinating people in the history of the entertainment business. But let's start with the most recent, a terrific piece you had recently in Esquire on Bob Rafelson. And for anybody who doesn't know who Bob Rafelson is or what he's meant in the world of entertainment, how would you briefly describe him?
Well, I think, you know, the two most identifiable things that Bob, you know, the people would know Bob for is, one, he created the Monkees, and then in totally the opposite direction, he directed the film Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson, which is as unlike the Monkees, right, as you're ever going to get. But he was really a guy who revolutionized, you know, when you hear about the term New Hollywood, Bob and his business partners were the guys who transitioned Hollywood out of the studio system into the early 70s when, you know, people like Coppola and Peter Bogdanovich and other people like that were making films because they were really smart and knew how to make movies on low budgets but with talented people. So, like, they funded Easy Rider, which I think they spent like about $400,000 on, and it made $70 million at the box office. They did the same with Last Picture Show, and they did the same with Five Easy Pieces. So they really are kind of the turning point where, you know, that old studio system with musicals and, you know, westerns and all that ends, and kind of modern filmmaking begins.
And he reached out to you to confirm the fact, or partially confirm the fact, that he wasn't actually dead.
He was, when I, you know, they had a, Esquire had kind of chased down Bob. They wanted to do a profile of him, and Bob is a great guy, but he's like a real, he's, you know, he's like a character from, you know, one of his own movies. He's this kind of grouchy, you know, tough customer, and he didn't want, you know, he's like, oh, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it. And then he sends me an email one day, and it's from a magazine in England, I think it is Sight and Sound, which is a big film industry magazine, and it's a issue all about Scorsese, and it talks about all the other directors of his era, and some of them, you know, it says aren't really, you know, working anymore. Some of them still make films, and then it said these guys are gone, and it's like Dennis Hopper, Robert Altman, blah blah blah, and Bob Rafelson. And he just sent me an email forwarding that, and it said, see, even the pros think I'm dead. And so that was kind of, and that's kind of like, that's a very kind of a summation of Bob's character. He got a huge kick out of the fact that they thought he was dead, and so it kind of went from there.
Well, and from your piece and from what I've read about him and what I saw in the documentary in the Monkees a few years ago, I feel like maybe the term larger than life could have been coined for him.
Yeah, that's an understatement. It was writing the article was difficult because he's first of all, he is larger than life. I mean, he's 86 years old, and he is like the last dude you'd want to get in a fight with, you know, and he's not, you know, he's a guy with two steel shoulders, all this, you know, surgery that's been done. But he's like nobody you want to mess with. He's like a big, kind of powerful character, both, you know, personally and physically. And he told these stories that were just unbelievable. And he, at, you know, one point, we emailed back and forth quite a bit, both before and after the interview. I spent like 3 or 4 days with him at his house in Aspen. And, interviewing him, but before and after that, he'd send me these great emails, and one of them said, you know, I've been imprisoned on 3 or 4 continents, you know, and they said, who counts? And he said, you know, including, you know, one time I was hung upside down from a jail cell, from the ceiling of a jail in Colombia with, and was being tortured, he said, but, you know, the worst thing was when they stopped electrocuting me, he said, the radio would go back on. It was always playing Perry Como. Like, that is like a classic Bob story. And he had story, and then he would end it with, he'd say, and then there was the time in Mombasa, and then end the email. It was, he has such a great sense of his own myth and legend, you know, so he would, you know, it just went on and on, and you know, fights with this person and that person, and you know, it just a fantastic guy, and yes, so much larger than life that it was not easy to fit all of him.
And it sounds like he doesn't need or want anything from Hollywood, but he would like it if people would maybe take a second look at a film of his that didn't get great reviews, didn't do well at the box office when it first came out, Mountains of the Moon.
Yeah, that was, you know, the whole reason Bob agreed to do this was that he's, you know, his favorite movie of his that he ever made is Mountains of the Moon, which came out in 1990, and it's about based on the true story of two explorers who are searching for the source of the Nile. And it's this great adventure in Africa. And I think he had the most fun making it. And I think it was a real departure from his other films, because all of his other films were kind of these quirky American movies, you know, like he made The King of Marvin Gardens, which is set in, you know, pre-casino Atlantic City. He made just these quirky, weird movies about weird places. And so I think for him, it was just this real departure, and he was so far from Hollywood and so far from the studios. And he loves, you know, situations where someone might shoot at him or where, you know, he might get stampeded by elephants. So this was like perfect. He was in Africa, you know, and everything was just kind of, he was just doing it as he went along, and he had a blast. And so he did the article because he wanted to promote, you know, Mountains of the Moon and get it back out in the world.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. I'm so obsessed, maybe not be too strong a word, with Doug Kenny and the early days of National Lampoon and everything that he did. I went back when we got you lined up. I went back and read your wonderful book, A Futile and Stupid Gesture, for a second time. Watched the Netflix movie that was based on it last year, and then watched the documentary again on National Lampoon. I know why I'm fascinated with Doug Kenny's story. What drew you to him?
You know, it was really a funny thing. I kind of the short version of the long story is I'm from Chicago, but I went to a boarding school outside of Boston, and I immediately was serving detention on Saturday morning in the library while I was there. And I never did my homework while serving this homework detention. And there was an Esquire issue of Esquire, I think from 1981 at the time, with Doug Kenny on the cover, and he had died. And I knew, you know, I grew up on all that National Lampoon stuff. I think I was 12 when Animal House came out. I was, you know, 14 when Caddyshack came out. So that was, you know, really formative stuff for people my age. And I only knew actually at the time that this was Stork from Animal House. And then I read this article kind of about his life and death. And it was a weird article. You know, he had died very mysteriously. He fell off a cliff in Hawaii at the age of 33. And he was just this great enigmatic genius, and everybody loved him, but nobody knew him. And he was such a, and also just such an immense talent. I mean, you look at any of the things he did, I'm not sure if he's not there, I don't think National Lampoon works. If he's not there, I don't think Animal House ever gets made. If he's not there, I don't think Caddyshack is any good. He is kind of the voice. He like is the one who got everything about their generation and about humor and how to make, you know, anything funny. So I was always interested in that. And then I just got this idea one time. I was like, God, you know, I'm writing magazine articles all the time, and I really want to do something more in depth. And I always kind of had the idea that I wanted to write something about Doug Kenny. And then, you know, realized that there was nothing past that article. And, you know, I think it was 25 years later when I went to work on it. So I started working on it, and it was also about kind of his rise and fall, coincided with the rise and fall of National Lampoon as, you know, the great American humor magazine. So it was a great, I mean, I was very lucky to get the story, because there are these two remarkable stories that kind of mirrored each other. So that was kind of it. I mean, but it really started, you know, while serving detention, which I guess is completely appropriate.
Absolutely.
Given the subject matter.
Such a fascinating relationship, too, with Henry Beard, two guys who could not have been more different, but that combination proved so incredibly potent and successful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, his best, you know, buddy, or his I guess, like, almost like, you know, work spouse was this guy who had gone to Harvard with, Henry Beard, who was like a, you know, Doug was a Midwestern Catholic kid who, from Cleveland, you know, who grew up in a middle-class family. And Henry was from, you know, a family, I think it one of his grandfathers or great-grandfathers had run against, you know, Ulysses Grant for president or something. I mean, he was real old money, East Coast, you know, New York City WASP, you know, who generations of his family had gone to Harvard. And Doug was this wild, you know, brilliant guy on one end who was kind of undependable, but also just so remarkably talented. And Henry was this really steady, really mature guy who was great at writing, like, straight on parodies of things. You know, he was just brilliant. Like, I remember he wrote, like, a female detective fiction. I mean, this is going to sound dated now, but in 1973, and it was like, it's like a Sam Spade novel or something, and I think it was called My Gun Is Cute, and it was supposed to be a woman, you know, writing that type of thing. And it was just like, he totally nailed exactly what, you know, some male would think a woman would write, you know, mystery in that time. And they're also both such smart guys. I mean, I think that's the thing that people don't realize about humor when you watch, you know, somebody like Stephen Colbert or Conan O'Brien or, you know, anybody who's, you know, really, you know, doing good humor, and there are lots of other people, is that, you know, first and foremost, they're smart. It's not that they're funny, first and foremost. They're smart. And because if they're not smart, their humor, you know, usually stinks. And these guys are really smart guys who happen to be incredibly funny. And they, you know, were perfectly matched. Like, Henry had it together, and Doug was a genius. So they, while it lasted, had an incredible partnership.
And he's such a sympathetic character because, despite his failings that he was fairly open about, he seemed to be quite open to people and quite a good colleague to be around. People couldn't help but love him, and always tinged with sadness, not only because of his early death, but he was never able to get out of the shadow of his brother Dan, who also died young.
Right. I think that was, you read enough biographies and see, you know, kind of follow this stuff enough, and you kind of see, you know, how these things that, you know, you don't identify in the moment is going to be a defining, you know, aspect of somebody's life. I think for Doug, that was, you know, his brother dying, you know, in his late 20s, and Doug was, you know, I think in his mid-20s, and Doug was in college. You know, that was such a defining moment for him, and I think Doug was this brilliant person who was a middle child who never fit in with his family. You know, and his brother was like a real normal American kid. And the family always thought very highly of him. And I think, you know, Doug's whole life, no matter what he did, he never felt like he measured up to his brother, who was just, you know, kind of like a normal, you know, American guy. Because Doug was like this misfit always. That said, he mastered the art of blending in with anybody. And everybody loved him. After the book was done, I knew that I'd start getting calls and emails from people like the ones I wound up getting, which would be, you know, some guy goes like, who would say, oh, you know, I was hitchhiking and Doug picked me up from Milwaukee, you know, he's like, and we drove all the way to Los Angeles together. Then I lived with him for 3 months. I mean, I got so many, I can't even count how many people contacted me. And literally there were stories like, they're like, oh, I was in a bar, and we spent, you know, a week together in Montana. You know, you just be like, what? So he was the kind of person who, you know, would befriend anybody, and not in a stupid way. You know, I mean, once he got rich and famous, he never stopped liking people, which I think is, you know, never thought he was above people and never thought that what he did was more important than anybody else. So he's a very sweet guy. I think that was one of the things that was great, is he could write really kind of biting comedy, but there was always this kind of affection beneath it that came through. You know, I think that was one of the things that made what he did work.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. You wrote Orson Welles' last movie. You co-produced the documentary They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, all about the making, the making and the odyssey that culminated finally in the release last fall of The Other Side of the Wind. Do you think Orson Welles would be happy with that finished product?
It depends on... There are a lot of ways to look at that. I'm sure, you know, he would be... My guess is he'd be publicly very gracious about it and very happy that it, you know, that it happened, and probably, you know, somewhere in heaven right now he's laughing at the irony of all of it. You know, and that he somehow got to come back when he was 100 years old and dead for, you know, 35 years. But I'm sure behind closed doors he would have, you know, they did a brilliant job finishing the film. I can't even imagine, like, Bob Murawski, who edited it, you know, having to edit an Orson Welles film that Orson Welles had not finished is, like, about as daunting as it gets. And Bob did an incredible job. I mean, he really, I think, is kind of the hero of the movie in that way. But I'm sure, you know, editing aside, I'm sure Orson would have said, oh, this is wrong. He would have, you know, he was a real, like, you know, not surprisingly, someone who loved to stomp around and, you know, complain about this and complain about that, and, you know, and talk about how he could have done this, now he would have done that, you know. So I'm sure you'd get both sides from him. He was, one thing I learned about him was he was like everything, every possible emotion, you know, he could feel about every single thing that happened. So he could be, you know, overjoyed in front of one person, furious in front of another, you know, all about the same thing.
The legend of Other Side of the Wind just continued to grow as time went on. Do you think there was a piece of Orson Welles that wanted it to remain unfinished to continue that legend?
Well, I think there was a piece of him, you know, I mean, I think, you know, and Doug Kenny too. I mean, I've been really lucky. I got to write about two of the smartest, most talented guys I could ever write about. And yet you realize that these people are human and that they have these massive Achilles heels and that they can even see their own faults and can't do anything about them. And that was kind of the case with Orson. I think, you know, he, on the one hand, there were people would say, they go, you know, yeah, sure, of course he wanted to finish it. It was suicide not to finish it for his career. But at the same time, he really liked getting up every day and just having a bunch of people do whatever he said, making a movie. And so he, in a way, it was like kind of subconsciously a way of keeping himself alive. You know, it was almost right. Like, you know, if I just keep making the movie, you know, I never die. So I know he wanted to finish it, but there was so much, you know, I think there was also this piece that he just loved making movies and this was his thing. So he could kind of do what he wanted. So he just kept making it and improving it and changing it. And you know, people died, not actually from making the movie, but people just got old and passed away during the course of making the film, which I always, you know, the Chief O'Hara from, Batman, Stafford
right.
Rep. He died in the middle of the making of the film. I mean, it was just so weird. And that was also great because all these weird famous people show up. Like, it took me, I think I was a year and a half into it, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, that's Chief O'Hara. You know? Wait. And that was kind of a fun part of the story is trying to find all these, you know, just out of nowhere people Orson put in the movie. And also he recast people as, you know, so he'd just right. say after 3 years, okay, that guy was terrible in that part. I'm going to put this person in. So you kind of had to find all these people. It's like a great, you know, it's like being a detective on a great hunt. So,
well, love the book and love the movie as well. Love all your work, Josh. This is great. I've had a wonderful time talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Hope you'll come
back again and we can chat some more.
Anytime. I would love to. Thank you for having me on the show.
That's Josh Karp here on Downtown. Read his books, Orson Welles' Last Movie, and A Futile and Stupid Gesture on Doug Kenny, The Early Days of a National Lampoon, and so much more.